I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Russia has spent $50 billion transforming Sochi into the site for the 2014 Winter Olympics that begin later this week. Almost $2 billion of that money was spent just on security. Sochi is in a tumultuous part of the world, a few hundred miles from Chechnya. There have been several suicide bombings in the region in the last few months, and the U.S. State Department has issued a travel advisory. Today on Radio Times, what to expect at Sochi. Sean Gregory is a senior writer who covers sports and Time magazine for Time.com, joins us on Radio Times. And Sean, nice to have you with us on the show.
Good morning. Thanks.
You're welcome. Also with us is Tom Goldman. He's NPR sports correspondent. He has covered 10 Olympic Games starting in 1992 and every one of them since 1996. He will not be traveling to Sochi. And Tom Goldman, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty. Nice to be here.
Tom, let me begin with you. Since you are not going to Sochi, why not?
You know how politicians like... No, you know how politicians like to say they're spending more time with their family? It's to do that. I've got two kids in high school, and it's a lot to leave my wife for a month at this point in time. So I'll be looking forward to Rio.
So nothing about security concerns at your end?
I made the decision about 6 months ago before the bombs went off in Volgograd. So, no, it doesn't have anything to do with that. And the team that we're sending, you know, I've talked to them and they had a little bit of, a little bit of nerves they talked about. But now that they're on the ground there, they're saying they're feeling a little more comfortable. Not surprising, at least in the Sochi area, with a reported 40,000 troops and police in place. It's kind of an arms state there.
Well, Sean, let me get you in on the conversation and talk a bit about this. I think they're calling it a ring of steel, or certainly the Time magazine called it a ring of steel in Sochi. Describe that for us.
Yeah, no, 40,000 law enforcement, troops, police, whatever you want to call them, on the ground, $2 billion in security alone, frequent, security checks at train stations, transportation hubs. The feeling when you talk to some people, read what you're reading, is that there is a feeling of safety. And obviously the region's been volatile, particularly the last few months with some of the suicide bombings in cities relatively close to Sochi. But you have to balance that out with, is it a police state? The Olympics are supposed to be this period of joy and fun, and how much fun can you have if everywhere you go, people have machine guns and that kind of thing. In Athens, it was like that a little bit, and you just kind of got used to things. Athens in 2004, there were a fair amount of terror threats, and there's a lot of similar kind of worries. Maybe the threats weren't as overt as they are here in Sochi. But the games go on. They always kind of go on, and God willing, there won't be any major incidents.
Well, Tom, on the one hand, it's good to have security. On the other hand, I guess there is some concern that it could put a damper on some of the celebrations, maybe even performances in Sochi.
Yeah, perhaps. But I think if you listen to athletes and talk to athletes, I think, most of them, while maybe feeling a little, some nerves, feel fairly secure. If the security people are going to protect anyone, it's the athletes, certainly after Munich in 1972. And these guys are going to, be inside this kind of bubble of security, although they are being told American athletes apparently are being told not to wear their uniforms, anything designating them as U.S. athletes when they go into downtown areas away from the bubble, if you will.
Well, and I'm curious, Sean, I'm assuming Time magazine is sending reporters to Sochi. Anything that Time is doing in particular to make sure the reporters are safe?
No, we're sending our Moscow correspondent, Simon Schuster, who actually just relocated to Berlin, but he's intimately familiar with the region and with Russia. So I haven't heard and don't believe that we're taking any kind of special precautions. When you're there, whether you're familiar with the region or not, you become, as reporters, you become part of the security bubble as well. Obviously athletes will get special treatment and kind of the biggest priority, but I've found as reporters, you're in the mix as well. You have security clearances, you have credentials to get places that other people can't. So I don't think we're taking any special precautions.
And how about Tom? How about for NPR? Is NPR doing anything special?
You know, nothing special. Now, we have had a number of briefings, though, leading up to this by security, security experts, I guess you'd call them. And matter of fact, members of the team were talking to me about that from 6 months out, something like that. They were having regular briefings. I never found out what the details were, but just an awareness of where they were going. And, and again, don't know the details.
Right.
But yes, we've been talking about it and certainly thinking about it.
Well, and Sean, there have been stories of as well of some family members, maybe even friends of some of the athletes, deciding not to go, just feeling that there's just too much, I guess, insecurity or questions about what may or may not happen in Sochi.
Yeah, no, and you know, recently there was a stat out that 30% of the tickets weren't sold, and you're hearing reports now about accommodations not being ready. And, you know, the last minute, there's always last minute construction, but it sounds like Sochi's cutting it closer than we've seen in past Olympics. So, yeah, there's definitely all kinds of security concerns and, you know, what are we going to find once we get there? So it'll be interesting to see over the next few days. These stories tend to go away once the games begin. You know, there's this week, the days before the opening ceremonies where, you know, reporters are looking for stuff to write about.
Exactly.
But we'll see if those go away once the torch is lit.
You know, Marty,
ahead,
if I could just interject here. You know, it's that old cliche, don't let the terrorists win. I think, sadly, in a way, already there has been somewhat of a victory in that this is such – well, look, you know, we're leading off talking
exactly
about this issue.
Right.
You had – I think it was Nicole Pincus Pace, one of the – forgive me. I think she's a skeleton racer, you know, who spoke at a news conference, and she talked about how she brought her young kids, both under 10 years old, and they were kind of running around after the press conference, and people – you know, the reporter was making – note, hey, they're running around. Isn't that cool? You know, it's kind of like political leaders kind of saying, look, I'm, you know, say there's water contamination. They're drinking the glass of water in front of the press to show that everything's good, you know. So we're all kind of talking about this, but, kind of saying, hey, we'll be fine. But and as Sean said, you know, the common areas at Olympics are really a big deal. And having experienced a lot of those, just wandering through where there are thousands of people, you know, from all over the world who were able to afford coming to the Olympics and just walking around and enjoying the local area, you just wonder how much of that is going to happen in Sochi.
Well, Sean, and I'm still trying to get over the fact that Russia has spent something like $50 billion or a little bit more than $50 billion on the Olympics. I think that is a record. Do you think that sort of levels or, I guess, increases the threshold for an Olympics these days?
Yeah, no, and it's a for Putin, it's a huge risk. I mean, $50 billion is the most in Olympic history, and it's for a Winter Olympics where there's far fewer events than for a Summer Olympics. You know, this Sochi's Olympic venues, mostly, if not all, were built from scratch. I mean, this is a kind of region. This was a vacation region. Now it's hosting a world mega event, and you know, 7 years ago, it wasn't prepared to do that at all. So, and then you have the allegations and evidence of corruption and overspending, and where's that money going? So there are all kinds of issues here. You know, I don't expect in future Olympics that price tag to be that high. I think this was pretty unique to Russia. But then again, with all every games we see security concerns and everything else, you know, would it be totally shocking if the price keeps going up?
Well, and Tom, I'm just curious, how did the Winter Olympics end up in Sochi, Russia?
There's a really good question. I had an Olympic historian talk my ear off last night, as a matter of fact, Dr. John Hoberman, who is from the University of Texas. He's an Olympics expert. I've talked to him for many years about the issue of doping, but he also knows a lot about Olympic politics and a lot about history. And he is just out of his mind in disbelief how the IOC would award it to a man like Vladimir Putin and a country like Russia. But the IOC has a history of that. It's an organization largely of people who have their heads in the ground and have this sense of entitlement and aristocracy to them. Now, this is, of course, Dr. Hoberman talking, but a lot of people echo that. I think how did Sochi get it? It came down to, people believe, the charisma of Vladimir Putin. They won by a narrow margin, and he apparently wowed the voting IOC member, Jean-Claude Killy being one of them, the great skier, who talked directly about Putin's charisma, how he was able to woo these woo the voters. So here it is, and at least going in, just looks like a number of disasters waiting to happen.
So should we call this the Putin Olympics as opposed to the Sochi Olympics, Tom?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. Sean, he's got a heck of a lot riding on this. He really does. You know, we think of China in 2008 and how they wanted this to be, the Chinese wanted this to be a forum on how we've arrived and we belong, in the world in the 21st century. So much so with not only Russia, but with Putin as well.
Well, Sean, I'm going to ask you an actual sports question because you have a piece in Time magazine titled The Enforcers, about these twins who, as the headline says, are stoking the rivalry between the United States and Canada. About a minute and a half before we have to say goodbye, but tell us about these twins.
Oh, yeah. It's women's hockey, and there's this great rivalry in women's hockey between the U.S. and Canada. The two countries are much better than the rest of the world. And, the Americans have the Lamoureux twins, and they're from North Dakota, Jocelyn and Monique, and they play an aggressive brand of hockey. In fact, they've gotten into two brawls with the Canadians during exhibition games, which has kind of ramped up the anticipation of what we might see in Sochi. So they're fun to watch. They play hard. And in women's hockey, there's this debate about whether checking should be allowed. It's not allowed yet, but we'll see going forward.
And this is this U.S.-Canada rivalry when it comes to hockey, now obviously involving female players as well.
Yeah, and women's hockey, it's a problem for global popularity that more countries aren't competitive, although Finland is coming up now. So the kind of focus is on them, and it's an intense game. And this is what the Olympics are all about. You don't hear much about women's hockey in the 4 years between Olympics, but now this is something, a rivalry, these exciting twin players from the U.S., Canada, great hockey history. It's something to really look forward to during these games from a sports point of view.
Well, Sean Gregory, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
No problem. Thank you.
You're welcome. Senior writer, he covers sports for Time magazine and Time.com. Tom Goldman from NPR, NPR sports correspondent, staying with us for the rest of the hour. We are talking about the Winter Olympics at Sochi. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Yes, we're talking about security, and we will also be talking about sports and the athletes. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at SimpsonMeadows.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Have you made a pledge of support to WHYY yet? We rely on you, our listeners, to help pay for the news and information service that we provide around the clock. It's really very simple. You decide what this service is worth. $5 a month, $10 a month, $20 a month. Then you pick up the phone and call 1-888-345-9499. You'll talk to a volunteer who will ask some very basic questions, and presto, you're done. Or you can go online to WHYY and do it yourself. It's really very simple. It's also the right thing to do, since since you know what you're getting for your contribution. We keep you informed about the local, national, and international news, and we introduce you to interesting people and ideas. Surely that's worth your pledge of support. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-WHYY. Pledge online at WHYY.org. Thank you very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman about the Winter Olympics. They begin later on this week in Sochi, Russia. Tom has covered 10 Olympic Games starting in 1992 and every one of them since 1996. Not traveling to Sochi for as he said, family reasons. We have spent a lot of time talking about security issues. We also do want to talk about some of the events and some of the competitors, and we do want to take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times if you have any questions or comments for Tom. Tom, I'm curious about the audience for the Winter Olympics, even compared to the Summer Olympics, and I'm assuming it's skating and skiing. Those are the big events that people tune into, and it is the winter. People are inside. Is there generally a big audience for the Winter Olympics?
Are you talking about a television audience?
Yes.
Marty, that's a really good question. I haven't seen it on TV for about since 1996.
That shows how
which is actually going to be exciting. I get to watch it with my kids. Generally, everything about the Winter Games is smaller. And from a reporter standpoint, it's actually kind of nice because you feel like you can kind of get a handle on it. The Summer Games are just huge. But yes, I believe there is, and you know, with the inclusion and the growth of so-called X Games style sports, I think the Olympics is trying to bring in a younger audience as well, and I think it's doing a good job. Although I'm afraid I don't have numbers in front of me.
Well, and obviously the internet playing a big role as well. This X Game is called slope style skiing. Do you know what we're talking about here?
Slope-style skiing along – now, you got slope-style skiing and slope-style snowboarding, and obviously, if I get this wrong, listeners can call in and tell me. But, you know, it's kind of like skateboarding on the slopes obviously, with snowboarding, that's like skateboarding. But it's going over a number of jumps and rails, you know, like you'll see at a skateboard park, people going over rails. And it's a pretty neat sport, the slope style, and that is going to be new as far as I believe. Slope style, either skiing or snowboarding are new these Olympics, and it's just going to add for some excitement, and it's very exciting to watch. People, you know, these guys are very talented. One of the people to watch in ski slope style is Nick Gepper of the United States, who's very good in it. And you know, they're going off these rails, they're going backwards down the mountain, they go over jumps and do these fantastic flips and twists and turns that, like any great Olympic athlete, make it look easy, but it's tremendously difficult. So that's fun and keeps the games kind of fresh, I think.
Well, and another new event, I guess, an event making its debut at Sochi are the female ski jumpers. And this was some Lindsay. There's a Lindsay Vonn. There's a Lindsay Vann. Lindsay Vann being part of this lawsuit to get this sport included in the Olympics.
Yeah. It amazing that it took this long. I think it was 1924 when ski jumping was first introduced, but finally they've made their way, and there's going to be just a tremendous amount of attention. And even though Lindsay Vann has been able to Lindsay Vann has gotten a lot of the publicity. Her teammates, actually, Sarah Hendrickson. I'm sorry, I may be getting that name wrong as well. Sarah Hendrickson. She's the 2013 world champ, but she's been out with knee surgery, and Sochi is actually going to be her first competition since August, and she will be going against a 17-year-old Japanese ski jumper who's been tremendous. And so it should be a good competition there. Just the fact that women are now being allowed to fly like the men should be a lot of fun.
And what was the resistance about? Why did it take so long to get this sport included?
You know, I think it had to do with some really arcane kinds of beliefs that women, you know, weren't able to or shouldn't, you know, put themselves at such risk. You know, even though, as Sean was talking about, they're playing hockey and beating each other up and so on. I think it had to do with a lot of that, a lot of arcane IOC rules, but no more.
You know, it's interesting when you see pictures of Sochi in the front, in the foreground, there are palm trees, and in the background, you see the mountains, and obviously getting ready for the skiing. My reading has also told me that Russians have stockpiled a lot of snow. It's been a little bit warm in Sochi in the last couple of days, but obviously getting ready for the slopes. Bodie Miller, his, what, fifth return to the Olympics?
Yeah, Bodie Miller, the old man, is back, and it's pretty amazing. You know, he did so well in 2002. He did horribly in 2006, and everyone said, you know, oh, Bodie just took it for granted, and he was partying too much. But he's back after missing the entire 2012 season. He underwent knee surgery, but he's back with a vengeance. He's been doing very well recently, and you know, there's certainly a lot of talk in this country, although a lot of great competition, certainly in the speed specialties of downhill and super G. He's got to look out for Axel Lund Svindal of Norway, who's tremendous in that discipline.
And that's Tom Goldman. Now, we invited him to join us in this hour of Radio Times to get us ready for the Winter Olympics beginning in just a few days in Sochi, Russia. We talked a bit about some of the security issues, and we also were talking about some of the competition, some of the athletes as well, and we want to know who and what you will be watching. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And again, Tom Goldman is NPR sports correspondent, and he has covered 10 Olympics games and joining us in this hour of Radio Times. I was also reading about this Michaela, I'm being very American here, I guess, this Michaela Schifrin, someone to watch in the slalom. What can you tell us about her?
18 years old, could be the youngest alpine medalist, I believe, for the U.S. in alpine skiing, and she's taken the women's sport by storm, really. And even if Lindsey Vonn were there, and she's not, she'll be spending a lot of time, I guess, walking around with Tiger Woods at the events and not actually skiing. But Michaela Schifrin has been fantastic, and she'll be the favorite in the women's slalom, and she's the reigning slalom world champion, and not bad at the age of 18. You know, a sport that does take some time to get pretty good at, and even last year people were starting to talk about her, even more so now that Lindsey Vonn is off the competitive radar screen. I believe Lindsey Vonn will be doing will be broadcasting. So she'll be able to talk a lot about her young rival.
Is Lindsey Vonn dating Tiger Woods? I asked you, Tom Goldman.
Lindsey Vonn is, not Lindsey Vonn.
Okay, we got to get our Vonns and our Vans straight here.
Exactly.
I was reading about this 55-year-old German prince, Hubertus von Hohenlohe. This is apparently his sixth Winter Olympics. He's a German prince, but he's going to be competing for Mexico, the country where he was born. What do we need to know about this German prince?
Pretty much all you've said.
Okay. I think took it all away from you.
And that's, I'm deflecting because I really didn't bone up on this. You know, it's interesting. You do get athletes like this, and I think it started with the Eddie the Eagle phenomenon in the Calgary Olympics, you know, and that was looked at as kind of a lark when someone, you know, who's really not qualified. And after Eddie the Eagle, the Olympics did shore things up and have, I don't know if they called it the Eddie the Eagle rule, but you're supposed to have a certain qualification levels. So obviously your 55-year-old gentleman from just about every country in the world, you know, has to have qualified to a certain extent. But yeah, there are people there for all kinds of reasons. Some of them, you know, 55, you're not going to be winning, but you're there to compete. And I think the IOC will embrace you as embracing the Olympic ideal and all that kind of stuff. And everyone will have a good laugh to see, you know, seeing this person complete their competition.
I was also reading, maybe it was on NPR, that he also is going to be wearing a mariachi ski suit.
Right.
Just
right.
to sort of add to the visuals,
yeah.
I guess.
Go big, right? You're in the Olympics. Everyone's watching. Why not?
Are you sad you're not going to be there, Tom, since you've been at so many other Olympics?
You know, I am. I have been getting pangs, really, as I've been talking to the people who are going for us, and there will be parts definitely that I will miss. You know, watching on TV, although NBC is going to have hundreds and hundreds of hours on all its, you know, broadcast arms of the Olympics, you just don't see it the same way, and I think I'm going to be frustrated. I get to see. I'm not at every event, obviously, at Olympics, but you get to see it, and you get to talk to the athletes, which is very exciting. And you know, it's just, and you get a feel for the place, which is one of the sad things about all the talk about terror, is that the Olympics, which are, you know, a crazy boondoggle when it comes down to it, just billions of dollars spent, so much more here in Sochi, obviously. But when it comes down to it, there are moments which are really nice when people from all over the world are interacting, when you have athletes showing great sportsmanship, if you can peel away all the politics and the money and so on, for these athletes, it really is a great moment. I mean, some of my neatest times were spent not talking to the people who won competitions, but the ones who finished, you know, 13th, 14th, but who were just over the moon, you know, over the top being there.
Well, I think that's one of the reasons that we watch. And I mean, there are all those corny stories that come out of every Olympics. And as you say, lots of money spent, lots of PR. But then there are those magic moments that seem to kind of leak through that feel very real and honest. And as you said, Tom, I mean, these are people that have spent years perfecting their skills.
Yeah. Oh, years for minutes of competition. I mean, you know, it just seems – I always kind of focus on figure skating because you're on that very thin blade and you have, you know, fallen so many times in practice and hurt yourself and gotten up and continue to skate. And I know figure skating gets laughed at a lot. I have a personal spot in my heart for figure skating. It's just – it's a fantastic athletic event. And really, you know, Marty, a lot of people talk about the X Games sports as being the real adrenaline sports and the dangerous sports. There are so many winter sports where athletes could get seriously injured or even killed, and including figure skating. You look at those pairs competition when they're lifting each other up over the man lifting the woman up over his head, and they're smiling, and it's an amazing feat of athleticism. It really is.
And speaking about feet, with those blades, you know, inches from someone's eye, for instance.
Yeah. I do want to take some time, because I don't want it to get away from us, to talk about a discipline within figure skating that I fell in love with, and I think a lot of people in the world fell in love with from the last Winter Olympics in Vancouver, the ice dancing. Ice pairs competition is always exciting because there are lots of spins and leaps, and ice dancing is different in that you always have to stay connected with your partner. And if it works and if it's flowing, it's absolutely gorgeous. And last Olympics in Vancouver, when Canadians Tessa Virtue and Scott Moir won the gold in a really tight competition with Americans Merrill Davis and Charlie White, and those will be the four going at it again in Sochi, it was absolutely ethereal. It was unbelievable. Virtue and Moir's performance rivaled Torval and Dean, the famous competition in 1984 in Sarajevo. Just absolute beauty and grace. And fascinating, too, it was one of those Olympic moments. It turned the games in Canada's favor. I think it happened, it was on the second weekend, the midpoint of the games, and the Canadians had been kind of worried leading up to that because they weren't medaling and they were kind of going the athletes were putting in tight performances and anxious. And Virtue and Moyer literally just kind of the dam broke after that, and Canada ended up owning the Olympics after that performance. It was really a special moment, much like the British had at London. In 2012, when they had a huge night in track and field and stunned everyone by winning 3 gold medals, and that really set them on their way. There are those moments in the games when that just will launch a team and the host team, because there's a huge burden on the host team to do well. And so those events that I talked about were two that I can remember that were just really significant.
Well, Tom, let me get Andy to join our conversation. And Andy, go ahead. You are on Radio Times. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I'm just trying to get you up. Hi. Actually, I was calling with a comment about ice skating in particular. I mean, my question was, hasn't it gotten too flamboyant? Hasn't it gotten away from what the Olympics are about when the discussion is what designer has done their outfit? And the second is, I take serious issue with the fact about ice dancing. I mean, I'm not questioning its grace and beauty, but then on the Summer Olympics, should we have ballroom dancing and ballet? In other words, is it really athletic?
Well, I'm glad you framed it that way, because I think it's an interesting way to discuss it. And Andy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Tom, what do you say?
Yeah. Absolutely athletic. I mean, there are other sports where you may want to question the athleticism. Curling, I'm talking about you. although we're not going to trash curling. I love that sport. No, I mean, look, you're – oh, my God. Look at these people, as I mentioned, yes, there's not the lifting and the spinning and the throwing that you have in pairs, but you look at these people come off the ice. They have worked out. They are breathing hard. They are sweating. And, and as Andy says, yes, the talk of all the outfits, yeah. That's the commentators. You gotta turn the sound. Well, if you turn the sound down, you won't be able to hear the music. But I think the athleticism is on full display. So I'm not so sure I'd agree with that.
Well, let me follow up with Andy. Are you going to say, Tom, that ballet is a sport as well?
Oh, with ballroom dancing. Well, ballroom dancing, again, very athletic. I mean, we're not talking. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm sorry, Marty, did you say ballet?
I said
ballet is an absolute sport. So, and who knows which way the Olympics are going. Sometimes there seems to be no rhyme or reason. Look at the way they got rid of women's softball, for one thing. I mean, I think that's an age-old debate, and you could have many beers over that debate about what is athletic and what is not. But I think the thing Andy brings up, actually are. And heck, ballroom dancing can be quite beautiful as well, in my opinion.
Andy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're almost up on a break here, Tom, but you're saying keep curling because of what? Tradition, history, because it's curling?
It's fun, and people wouldn't have anything to bash if they got rid of curling every time the Winter Olympics come around. But it's fun. It was in Canada last time, and it was absolutely thrilling to see the gold medal winning match by the Canadians, even though I kind of didn't understand what was going on at the time.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are getting a preview of the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. They begin later on this week. And again, Tom Goldman, our guest. He's NPR's sports correspondent. He has covered 10 Olympic Games, joining us from his home across the coast here. Stephen Wilson waiting in the wings. He's the Associated Press's European sports editor, and he'll be joining us from Sochi, Russia. You can join us as well. Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at @WHYYRadioTimes, and we'll take your questions and comments after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Opera Philadelphia presents Ina Damar, Fountain of Tears, the Grammy Award-winning opera about the life and death of Federico Garcia Lorca. This Spanish production makes its only U.S. appearance in Philadelphia and features flamenco dancing by the Antonio Gades Company. Ina Damar is a celebration of an artist's struggle for love and free expression. Ina Damar at the Academy of Music from February 7th through 16th. Tickets and information at operaphila.org or by phone at 215-893-1018.
I'm Marty Moscoane. We're in the middle of the winter membership campaign, and we want you to become a member, a supporter, a subscriber. If your membership has lapsed or you've never been a member, do it now, and it's really very simple. I know you'll feel good when you do it. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. Again, 1-888-345-WHYY. You can also pledge online at WHYY.org. Today on Radio Times, we're doing a preview of the Winter Olympics at Sochi with three guests, a Time reporter, Sean Gregory, on security, NPR's Tom Goldman on the athletes, and the Associated Press's Stephen Wilson in Sochi. Then our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Philip Schultz, who has written a new novel in verse. That's the kind of diverse programming you hear every day on Radio Times. We're curious about many things, and we think you are too. 1-888-345-9499, WHYY.org. Thanks very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman. And joining us now is Stephen Wilson. He's the Associated Press's European sports editor, has been covering Olympic games for about 20 years now, and joins us from Sochi, Russia. My fingers are crossed, Stephen Wilson, that we have a good connection. And thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure. I'm here in Sochi. I hope you can hear me well.
We hear you actually quite well. Describe Sochi for our listeners. There are many people that have seen pictures and we're getting ready to watch the games. What does Sochi look like?
Well, it's really, first of all, geographically, it's an unusual location. It's a subtropical resort. On the coast where we are at the moment, it's pretty balmy kind of weather. It's along the Black Sea. It's there's palm trees in sight. And then you go up about 45 minutes to an hour outside Sochi, and you're up in the mountains full of snow. So it's unusual kind of layout. At the moment, we're counting down the final hours and days till the opening ceremony, and there's a lot of work still going on. There's still a bit of construction here and there. Hotels are being prepared. There have been some problems there. Mm-hmm. Flags are going up. They're dressing up the city a little bit more and more. So we're almost ready to start.
Well, we've been talking a lot about some of the security concerns and issues in Sochi, and this is something like 40,000 police or troops on the ground there. Do you see visible presence of troops?
You know, it's not all that obvious. The troops, the police, the security are spread out all over the place. We're here in the kind of enclosure of the Olympic Park area, which is a secure perimeter. So once you're inside that perimeter, it's a pretty free environment, I could say. So you don't see that much of the security. Getting in is where you have to go through the usual mag and bag checks. It's like going through an airport. But it's really not an overwhelming presence, I would say, even though, there are supposed to be tens of thousands of military, police, and other security personnel involved in this operation, which is probably perhaps the biggest security operation we've ever had for the Olympics.
And will the venues, will the hotels, will they be ready when everyone arrives?
Well, that's been an issue. The venues themselves look ready. In fact, they look they're brand new, they're shiny, they're gleaming. Everyone speaks highly of them. I think the athletes will love them. I think it'll look good on television. But behind the scenes, there have been some headaches, some problems, some glitches with the accommodations, the hotels, particularly in the mountain areas. A lot of people have shown up to find that their hotel is not ready. The room may not be ready at all. They've been have to switch hotels. They've had to wait. There's been a lot of anxiety about that. And I think that will continue for during the week as more and more people arrive, because and it will be a big concern if some of the athletes' families and friends show up and find out that the hotel that they booked is not actually existing or doesn't have their rooms ready.
Tom, let me go back to you, Tom Goldman, because you've covered a whole bunch of Olympics, including Salt Lake City. This was in 2002, just a couple of months after September 11th, and of course, great security concerns at Salt Lake City. Do you see some parallels between Salt Lake and Sochi?
Well, yeah. I mean, certainly the talk, the numbers are really interesting. The number we've been saying, an estimated 40,000 troops, police, whatever you want to call it, in the Sochi area, in Salt Lake City, as you say, right after, pretty close after 9/11, there were a reported 13,000. So a lot bigger presence, and even though there were you know, the world was on tenterhooks, obviously, after 9/11. But I think the difference here is that as far as, you know, it's not just a terror threat. We've actually, you know, seen in the last couple of months actual attacks that make it credible. And you have groups, some separatist groups who have made some very strong and threatening statements about people dancing on the graves of their ancestors when they come to the Olympics. So, but certainly, yeah, parallels yeah. there.
Stephen Wilson, going back to you in Sochi, if people do come to protest in Sochi, are there places for them to protest? Are those going to be prevented by those troops on the ground?
Well, there's actually an official protest zone. There's a single one, and that was decided upon a few weeks ago under some pressure from, I think, the International Olympic Committee wanted that to happen. But it's really a small little place. It's a park away from the Olympic venues. It's not going to be a large-scale protest zone that we're used to in other countries. And so there have been a few minor protests by communist groups there in the last few days, but it won't be much more than that, I think.
I was reading you did some reporting, and some others have done some reporting about shooting stray dogs in Sochi, which, you know, frankly just breaks my heart. But what can you tell us about that, Stephen?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's true that there's many stray dogs in the area, especially around the construction sites, and you know, construction workers tend to feed the dogs, so they you know, you see them in different places, and apparently the Russians feel it could be an embarrassment towards them, and they have an official sort of dog catchers and things that are out to catch them and exterminate them, and I know a lot of animal lovers won't be happy mm-hmm. about that.
And is the U.S. delegation there yet?
There's plenty of U.S. Athletes and officials here already. There'll be more coming as over the next few days. But yeah, they're here in Sochi. They're up in the mountains. The athletes have started to train. They've been giving some press conferences. So, the opening ceremony is only 3 days away. So we'll see a large delegation of Americans in that ceremony.
And final question to you, Stephen: where will you be everywhere over the next couple of weeks?
Well, I'll try to as much as possible. The good thing about these games is the layout, as I pointed out. It's relatively compact, more than most games. Here in Sochi itself, we have this Olympic Park where you can really essentially walk to almost all the indoor venues within a close area, which is unheard of in the Winter Games, really. And then only 45 minutes or an hour's, you know, train ride or bus ride away, you're up in the mountains. You can go watch the alpine skiing, freestyle, Nordic, ski jumping, luge, etc. So I'm going to try to get to see as much as I can, hopefully, because there's a good chance to do it.
And are we talking new roads, new train systems, you know, everything kind of brand spanking new?
Absolutely. I mean, these games, everything has been built from scratch, literally everything. I mean, this was a decaying Stalinist resort, which the Russian government decided they want to rebuild into a year-round tourist destination. They wanted to make it a winter sports complex for the entire country. So that's what you've heard about the astronomical figures that have been spent on these games. $51 billion in total, if not more. And a lot of that money, I would say, is really towards that infrastructure, to the roads, to the railways, to the tunnels, to the other infrastructure which Russia hopes to leave behind as a legacy for decades to come.
Well, Stephen Wilson, thank you so much for joining us for this portion of Radio Times today.
My pleasure.
And he's the Associated Press's European sports editor, joining us from Sochi, Russia. Tom Goldman staying with us for the rest of the hour. He's NPR's sports correspondent. And we're getting kind of a preview of the Winter Olympics about to begin in just a couple of days. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Tom, I'm going to take advantage of the fact that you've covered so many Olympics, and one wonders, you know, when all the athletes and all the news crews go home, what happens to those buildings? I mean, what happens to all the infrastructure that's been built to support the Olympics? And I'm assuming it's probably a different story depending on what city we're talking about.
It is, yeah, and it's become much more a part of the whole process of building these things to make sure that you have a plan for them afterwards. Because we've seen examples. I remember on some website recently, they were showing pictures of old facilities in Sarajevo at the 84 games, yeah. And just absolutely run down and and not used at all, and. It does depend on the games, but they build these unbelievable palaces for the games, and then it really does remain to be seen how well they're used. I remember them talking about the Bird's Nest in Beijing, that incredible main stadium. I still don't know what they're doing with that. I think the plan was to use it in some capacity, and I'm sure it is being used. It's not just laying fallow, whatever. But I think in general, and we had a couple of pieces on this this week, is in fact from London and from Greece on Morning Edition. Basically, the message was the Olympics are a great party, but not a very good investment. So whether they can capture the whole value of of the $51 billion, certainly in Sochi and billions of others at other Olympics, that certainly remains to be seen.
Well, as we know, all Olympics have their political parts, and President Obama will not be attending the opening ceremonies. I guess a kind of a protest against this law, a relatively new law in Russia, the sort of gay propaganda law, as it has been called. He did choose Billie Jean King and some other out sports
Brian
stars.
Boitano,
yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. To be there mm-hmm. to represent the United States. Do you see this as an important part of the Olympics?
Absolutely, and I'm glad we're talking about this. We would be remiss not to. This is one of those things. This is one of those issues that could not go away. I think we talked earlier in the show about how once the games start, there's this lead up this week before the games. Everyone's talking about infrastructure and transportation problems, and on and on and on. But once the games start, the games start, and it's like you shoot into the rapids, and every day is a new drama athletically. And God forbid, hopefully we won't have any terror problem. But this issue with Putin's gay propaganda legislation has the potential to resonate throughout the games. And by that I mean we're going to be very interested to see if any athletes make any statements a la Tommy Smith and John Carlos at the 1968 Mexico City Olympics when they famously raised their gloved fists on the medal stand. We're going to see how many athletes get involved in the so-called Principle 6 campaign. That's named after the clause in the Olympic Charter that supposedly guarantees non-discrimination. Well, it's abhorrent, this gay propaganda legislation that Putin has passed, and there are reports that there's vigilantism going on, some in Russia are equating homosexuality with pedophilia, and it's a very, very, very ugly thing. And it will be very interesting to see what happens with the athletes. Certainly, some of them are gay, and whether they will speak out. The IOC has said they are allowed to make political statements at news conferences, but not at venues, and they could be sanctioned if they make them at venues. But that is something we will definitely be watching. We will see how much freedom NBC commentators have to talk about this. You can imagine the talks going on between the IOC and NBC, which is such an important stakeholder in the Olympics, how much they'll be able to say publicly about this. It will be very interesting to watch the figure skating with Johnny Weir, a man who is who is out, and whether Johnny Weir will say, make any statements about this, the legislation. And he has said already that he's going in the spirit of the games and he's not going to stir things up. But Johnny Weir has a history of stirring things up. So we will see what happens there.
And that's Tom Goldman. He's NPR sports correspondent joining us during this hour of Radio Times, getting us ready for the Winter Olympics, spending a lot of the hour talking about things like security, discrimination, and, of course, sports. 1-888-477-9499. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Tom, just even picking up on what you just said, I see a quote from the mayor of Sochi basically talking about gays and lesbians saying, quote, we do not have them in our city. The sort of level, I guess, of denial is pretty breathtaking, especially in the year 2014.
When we heard that, that spurred a number of snarky comments among with me and with our Olympic reporters to say, well, there's a story. We've got to go out and find a gay person in Sochi, you know, and there reportedly are a couple of gay bars and people are scoffing at this. But it really does show just, you know, this antiquated idea and the fact that this has been, you know, this has become formal legislation in this country tells you a lot about where this country is and takes us way back to the question that you asked, how did Russia get these games,
yeah.
You know, and the IOC overlooking issues like this. There are a lot of critics who would say that is just not good.
Well, Tom, let me end on a sports or an athlete question. So we talked a bit about some of the skiers, some of the skaters. You'll be in front of your TV, I guess, like the rest of us mere mortals here. What will you be looking for then?
You know, what I will try and get a sense of, I'd like to give you a specific athlete or a specific event. I won't. What I will be looking for is what I mentioned earlier, the drama of each day. What is the story that's told? I remember getting up every morning, never having to worry about, gee, I wonder if anything's going to happen at the Olympics, because something always happens at the Olympics. And hopefully, you know, that won't involve terror. It'll involve sports, but also on a political level, it'll involve some athletes making some brave statements too. It will be a fascinating time, as always.
Well, I will tune in for that. And as always, Tom Goldman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's always a pleasure. Talk to you in 2 years.
Yes, indeedy. And he's NPR sports correspondent. Again, he's covered 10 Olympic Games, joining us from the West Coast where he lives. We also talked with Sean Gregory, senior writer who covers sports for Time Magazine and Time.com. And we checked in with Stephen Wilson. He's the Associated Press's European sports editor, joining us from Sochi, Russia. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you for joining us in the first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.